step up and speak out.
This is a good evening. Is the FM stereo, my station, your station, the hottest radio in town. The name is Larry Quaid. Right, is the platform. I'm with you until half past the hour of 8 o'clock. Thank you very much for joining us. But before I tell you about what we're discussing today, just to say, just to apologize, we advertised earlier that we'll be having the Secretary General of the MDC coming in, but he won't be coming in anymore. So we had advertised that earlier, but he won't be coming into the show anymore. Just to apologize for that. That's what we had advertised earlier. That show is no longer happening. But today, before I talk to you about what we're talking about today, just remind you of some of the frequencies of Victoria Falls: 106.5, Nyanga 98.2, Gweru 104.3, Valawi 106.7, and we're broadcasting out of Harare on 106.4. Over the internet is www.zfmstereo.co.zw. If you want to listen to us over your phone, just go to download the TuneIn app via whatever platform that you're using, and then just and look for TuneIn, and then you can listen to us live and in charge. Our phone lines are open. WhatsApp is 0731 168 045, and our caller number is 0772 168 045. And if you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, it's at ZFM Stereo. On Facebook, facebook.com/ZFM Stereo. On Instagram, at ZFM Stereo ZW. Now, the International Monetary Fund has predicted that Zimbabwe will slide into a recession of 5.2% this year, contrary to their previous forecast that had projected a growth of at least 4.2%. This is the first time the nation will go into recession since 2008, when it contracted by double-digit percentages. Re-engagement has been the buzzword from the halls of new government complex, and the IMF in this instance has made its move and decided to make a proclamation. We're going to be discussing this on this program this evening. And in the studio tonight, I've got the former Minister of Economic Planning and Investment Promotion, and it was also the MDC MP for Hatfield, and today speaking as an economist more than anything else. Thank you very much for joining in.
Thank you. Good evening.
And also in the studio, I've got an economist in Brian Muchemwa. Thank you, both of you, for joining in.
Thank you, Larry.
And as I said, 0731 168 045 is our WhatsApp number. Our calling number being 0772 168 045. Now, first of all, what is your prediction, starting with you, Honorable Mashagada? What is your opinion on the latest IMF prediction and the implications of it?
Well, to begin with, IMF are not angels. They can also err in their projections, in the assessment of economies. Therefore, a lot of water has to flow under the bridge before we can validate their predictions. But I just want to tell you how the IMF operates, their method of assessment, so that at least we put this into a context. What the IMF does is that they do what we call Article 4 consultations. They come into a country with a technical team, then they assess the macroeconomic framework. By macroeconomic framework, I look at things like the GDP growth forecasts, they look at the budget deficit, they look at your inflationary trends to come up with a projection of how the direction the economy is taking. And having done that macroeconomic framework, they also look at the fluctuations that can happen in the economy, the shocks, what they call macroeconomic shocks, that can happen in the economy to deviate from the growth path and other targets. So they also analyze those macroeconomic shocks. I'm sure we are going to discuss those macroeconomic shocks. Mm. Then they also look at your policies. And they call them adjustments, fiscal adjustments and macroeconomic adjustments. What are the policies you are doing in the fiscal area and macroeconomic area to meet your targets? But most importantly, they work with your figures, what you expect to achieve, and your own assumptions. So when they talk of a recession, basically they are telling you that there are growth challenges. We won't register buoyant growth. We won't register positive growth because of a number of factors which we are going to unpack in this session. I think I can stop there.
Same to you, Brains Michelle. What's your first of all your impression of the IMF prediction?
Yeah, you see, like what Tapio said, you know, what the IMF does, it just summarizes the opinions of the key policymakers and the key opinion makers in this economy. So this figure that they would have thrown would have come from the wide consultations that they would have had with the business community in particular. But my thinking is that they might have been a bit over-optimistic, because I think the issue is that everyone has been quite optimistic in terms of the projections on inflation. Even if you look from a policy perspective, even if you look at the exchange rate, I don't think there's anyone who had actually thought that by now we'd be talking of parallel rates of in upwards of 4.5%. So my thinking is that, yes, definitely we are heading into a recession, but it can probably be much worse than the 5.6 or 5.8. I'm not seeing corporates being able to maintain working capital. I think the biggest challenge that corporates have today is to maintain working capital. And if you can't maintain working capital, what it means is that you cannot be able to maintain volumes, you see. So if you can't maintain volumes, then it becomes very difficult for this economy now to actually avoid a recession. More so when you look at the fact as well that the real consumer demand in this economy has crashed, you know, to levels probably last seen in 2009, when you look at real disposable incomes, because of inflation. Of course, the level of inflation has been reported at 70% for March, there about 66. But when you look at the actual disposable incomes and how much they have been pulverized by inflation, it's much more than 66%. So definitely we are in a recession, and I think what is important from a policy making perspective is to understand and accept that we're in a recession, so that at least we then run with the right policies. It has to get worse before it gets better. Definitely we've got a huge balloon of RRTGS balances in this economy that are not properly valued, and until such a time that the exchange rate corrects that, I'm not seeing a situation where this economy can be expected to grow.
Just to read one of our first messages, yes, says, I'm sure the IMF is right because the trend is already being experienced. People are not spending. There's Andy in Zimba. Before we get into those aspects, Honorable Mashagada, the question I want to ask is, you touched a bit on it, but what is the reason behind this recession?
Thank you very much. The reason behind this recession is what we call downside risks. When you look at growth, it is affected by downside risks. And the greatest downside risk at the present moment is the question of foreign exchange or foreign currency. The economy is not able to generate enough export earning capacity so that we can get enough foreign currency to drive our industries, to meet all our nostril demands. For importers, and whether in terms of machinery or raw materials and other goods that we require, like fuel and medicines and so on and so forth. So the productive sector is choked because there isn't enough foreign currency. And that touches on what Brian said, the question of working capital. Working capital, both in terms of RRTGS currents as well as in terms of foreign exchange. So we have got foreign exchange constraint, which constrains growth. That's one thing. The other problem is that, which is a symptom now, the fuel shortages. The economy cannot grow with this intermittent fuel shortages. Because fuel drives the economy, diesel drives the economy, and with those shortages, it becomes a problem. But more fundamentally, production. Our economy has not been producing, we've been consuming. If you look at our import bill, it shows that the economy structurally is import dependent. We have not been able to ratchet up production because lack of FDI and also lack of domestic investment. Well, the companies, as you said, are not able to invest to generate growth. And the biggest problem is that if you look at the policies that we have in place, like the stabilization program, it's not a growth. It's not a program that gives economic stimulus. Right? We are concentrating on balancing the books, stabilizing. In fact, stabilization means we are stopping the bleeding first. there's been a lot of bleeding in the economy, so the minister is trying to stop the bleeding and balancing the books. So we are not yet in a growth trajectory. So we still need a stimulus that can create a growth, generate jobs, and create more wealth into the economy. So we have still balancing figures. So this depression is going to be driven by lack of demand, as he said. Real incomes are low, salaries are static, they are stagnant, so we don't have effective demand. And once we don't have effective demand, there is no stimulus to industry to produce for consumption. So that's a problem. The other challenge is the budget deficit. We are still trying to fill the holes that we dug. Before we even build, we are still trying to fill the holes.
But then the question I want to ask, and it's fascinating the way you're putting it across, and I think it's a very simple way for one to understanding at home, and thank you very much for simplifying it in that way. And do get in touch with us on 0731-168-045. You have a situation right now where the aspects of the recession that you're talking about, where we're talking about balancing the books, stabilizing and so forth. How does one stabilize when there is no expenditure? Because you're going to need to find that money from somewhere, and there has to be some form of growth for there to be somewhere. So how do you, even if it's domestic or foreign investment, attract any form of investment?
Yeah, in fact, what they're trying to do is to balance the books, to make sure that expenditure is contained within the revenue envelope, so that we don't spend what we don't have. But that's not enough. What we are looking at is going beyond this stability to create a surplus savings, government savings, which can be then reinvested into the economy. If you don't have savings, whether at individual, private, individual level, at company level, and government level, if you don't have savings in the economy, it's very difficult to grow the economy, because we need those savings to be mobilized and redeployed. You know, investors will come and borrow that money and put into industry, into production. So just balancing the books alone is not enough. You need to register more surpluses so that that can be reinvested into the economy through savings mobilization.
So in that aspect of savings mobilization, we already talked about how the spending capacity of the average person who actually drives the spending within the economy has been decimated, essentially. How then do you move towards creating an investor culture from that? Or do we have to wait until what point at which it becomes comfortable enough for investors to come in? Because ultimately, investors want to come into a country where people are spending.
Yeah, that's true. Of course, it depends with the... Of course, it depends as well with our comparative advantage and the type of investment that we can attract as a country. Remember, in this country, you wouldn't really expect a lot of investment that comes into manufactured goods or into, services. You'd expect most of the investment to actually be coming into the extractive sectors of the economy, because that's where we have a bit more comparative advantage, you see. When you look at investment that flows into sub-Saharan Africa in particular, Southern Africa and so on, it's slightly chasing comparative advantages and not competitive advantages. But when I look at the challenges that we are talking about, and indeed the aspect of the decimated disposable incomes, I think we are suffering from the aftermath of excessive subsidies. Remember, we had subsidies not so long ago on fuel, on beer, on everything, really. This country had been running on subsidies, we're high on cocaine, on subsidies. And it was not sustainable. I guess there's been a voice out there for a long time that, look, you cannot afford to subsidize every basic commodity for everyone, you see, the way we're doing, with the one is to one. And what that did, it drove our money supply growth significantly, and it drove through the roof. It shot through the roof, you see. So what we are now seeing, all the adjustments that we are seeing on the pricing levels, on the exchange rate, etc., they are all trying now to, they are now absorbing the effects of excessive money supply that was pumped into this economy. And unfortunately, once you print money, there's no way of taking it out. The only way to stabilize or to to recalibrate the economy would be to allow the price levels to rise. So what we are seeing now, until such a time that, because, so for me, there are two issues that we need to deal with. We need to understand that this economy has to, things have to get worse before they get better. I think that is a fact that we need to live with and understand. And secondly, I think the most important thing is that for these things to actually stabilize much faster, we then need to curtail additional money supply growth and remove the subsidies that are still, there are some subsidies, implicit subsidies that are still existing in the economy. So at the present moment, I think our money supply is running at around 25% growth per annum, which I believe is very excessive when you look at the GDP growth in this economy, you see. So in my opinion, the debate on where and how we can come out of this whole mess that we are in right now, I think it really hinges on the ability and commitment by the central government to manage money supply. If you look at all our problems in this country ever since 2002 and thereabout, they've all been emanating from excessive money supply growth, to the extent that even an investor wants to come into this country would assess their risk from a money supply perspective to say, the rate at which this country is generating domestic money, would I be able to extricate my dividends in real US dollars, you see?
But then the question I want to ask is, we're saying in one section that, and either one of you are willing to answer it, or if you're willing to answer it, or both of you can answer it. If we're saying at the same time there's excessive money supply, mm-hmm. and at the same time we're saying people don't have enough money, which way is it?
Yeah, you see, you have money, but it's worthless. That's the issue. So it's not about the nominal values. It's about the real values. So you find out that, yes, money supply. So what money supply does, like he's been saying, our ability to generate foreign currency does not really change that much, you see. But our ability to generate the local currency has been, we have actually been able to accelerate the growth of domestic money supply without necessarily having a concomitant increase on the foreign currency. So what it has done is that you now have a lot of broad money supply. So we have nominal terms, yes, money supply volumes have grown up, have gone up. That's why the price of bread now is $2. You see, so, but it doesn't necessarily mean, however, that the real this money is retaining its original spending power.
So could the argument then be also say that if we're saying there's a lot of money supply, mm-hmm. it could be 10, 15 people who've got a large percentage of the money supply, and the you know, when we're talking about how the capacity for people to spend has been eroded because their salaries are not going up, their income is not going up, so which means is there that much excessive money supply?
Honorable, yeah, maybe Shekhar. I can just add there. The money supply arises from the issuance of treasury bills.
Mm.
Yeah, those money market instruments which government pumped into the economy to try to cover the budget deficit. So it's equivalent to printing money, because you are just borrowing and there's no value to it. So it's equivalent to printing money. But the other dimension I want to touch on is the what we call currency depouching.
Mm.
The crisis we have in Zimbabwe is that our currency has been under attack. It has been devalued for so many times because of hyperinflation. With our hyperinflation in 2008, when we were using the Zim dollar, but post 2014-15, we also had a crippling inflation. Even in US dollar terms, we still had rising inflation. And yet the US dollar is supposed to stabilize your prices, but we still had people trying to profit here, charging prices that are really out of this world. And that has led to currency debauchery, right? Because the loss of value of the currency. So linked to that, we have to address the currency issue so that we can then generate growth in the economy. Right now, I'm not comfortable with our current situation, this RTGS. We've got to have money, either in the US dollar form or in the Zimbabwe dollar form.
There has to be a finality on that.
Yes, there has to be a finality. We have to put closure to that. And I think that is now leading to speculative pricing. And now, as prices are rising, There's internal devaluation on the other hand. Internal devaluation, wages are being suppressed, incomes are being suppressed, and there's call for utilities to be reduced. So that's internal devaluation. But on the other hand, you are increasing the prices of basic commodities. So there's a mismatch now between demand and supply, and people cannot afford the cost of living in Zimbabwe, because there is internal devaluation, and yet there's hyperinflation, crippling. You say it's 66 as of March. Yeah. So it's not a healthy situation. It has to be checked. So I see that we need to anchor our economy on a strong currency. And in my view, the rand, I've always argued that perhaps let's end at the rand monetary union or the rand monetary area, because 60% of our imports or our trade is with South Africa. So we can easily access the rand. We've got 1 million people in South Africa. They can do remittances back home in rand and flood the market with rand, and therefore we can have a reasonable liquidity. The US dollar, the problem is that it's a strong currency. It can lead to overvaluation. Our own Zim dollar will be based on what? There's no value. There's no production. There's no value. We don't have foreign currency reserves. And our trade deficit doesn't justify the introduction of a local currency. So I would tend to say that to underpin our growth, let's migrate the usage of the rand as a medium of exchange.
Before we take a break, I want to ask this question. So you can give it a think as we take the break. Could there have been a situation where businesses felt, because we were earning US dollars here, they were earning US dollars here, they didn't feel the need to export to try to earn from weaker currencies like South Africa and so forth within the region, and that could have lent to the lack of production within the economy? Stay tuned to ZFM Stereo, my station.
The platform. Step up and speak up.
Stay tuned into ZFM Stereo, my station, your station, the hottest radio in town. The name is Larry Quiteray. We are in the middle of the platform. We are talking about IMF's pronouncement that we're going to have a recession of 5.2%. One of my guests says it's probably worse than that. My other guest says, no, let's see what happens. The IMF can be wrong about these things. It might be worse. It might be better. Who knows? Just going to read a couple of messages here. It says, what we have is a governance crisis, not an economic crisis. These RTGSM bonds are worthless and have no value. Cannot preserve value via statutory instruments, but by policy consistency and good governance. Of course, one of the key things that's always talked about is policy. Is there anything within the policy? I know we've made reference to the TSP in as far as you know, trying to stabilize. But is there any policy that is in place that could encourage the growth in some area of the economy, in as far as this is concerned? We're going to start with Dr. Mashagada in the studio.
The non-policy at the present moment, official policy, is the transitional stabilization program. That's the official policy of the government. And I've already told you that stabilization is balancing of books. It doesn't need, it can create conducive conditions for growth, but it doesn't give you a growth trajectory. What you need is transformation, economic transformation, to make sure that your productive sectors are geared and supported to produce and expand and export. At the present moment, the only driver of growth, there are two drivers of growth. That is, the mining sector has got the potential to drive growth. But the problem with the mining sector is that we all know lack of value addition, lack of beneficiation. So we are losing value. We are exporting jobs. We are losing value there. The other sector is the consumer sector. That's a fast expanding sector. Consumption, insurance companies, commerce, and so on. It's also a growing sector. Agriculture this year is going to be affected by the climatic conditions, by climate change. If you do a cross crop assessment, I think already the Ministry of Agriculture is indicating that it's going to be a poor yield. And yet agriculture is the mainstay of the economy. And also the incentives, talking about policy, we also have to look at the incentives that we give to producers. Look at the tobacco. Right. We said we are going to pay them half in foreign currency, and then we've changed that. So policy consistency is very important in order to give incentives to producers. If you are not consistent in your policy, that can also affect future yields in the economy.
And on top of that, I've got a message here that comes to say policy inconsistency is killing the RTGS dollar, says EG Tulingubele latest statements in America don't give confidence to the market. And given that, just to go before we move forward with that, I had asked before the question before the break the question about earning what is essentially foreign currency, one of the strongest currencies in the world here. Did that have an effect on the appetite to grow the to grow manufacturing in order to export?
I don't think so, because you see, businesses or the motive of getting into business is to make money, really. So if you can get the money in Zimbabwe, fair and fine, you see. And in any case, until such a time that the economy would have been saturated, you see, you don't usually just want to export, take huge risk, etc., when you can equally, you know, get a better return on the domestic market. So to some extent, yes, definitely it might have affected, you know, the desire by the especially on those on the manufactured goods to take a risk of exporting. But when I look at it from a practical perspective, you know, at the end of the day, we really need to interrogate the purpose why people get into business, you see. And until such a time that this market would have been saturated, then surely, you know, it made sense to not to export. But if you then look at what was happening now, you see, what people need to understand is that when there are huge margins in a particular industry, it attracts a lot of investment. That's why you find we had a deflation for quite a long time. 4 or 5 years, prices generally going down in US dollar terms. It's because when there are huge opportunities, you attract a lot of investment, you see. So when that investment now is excess capacity, then you start exporting. So to me, it was not a bad idea. It was not a bad policy. It was not a bad idea at the time, because in any case, all the excessive or the overcapacity that would have been created in the industry would then have been vented on exports.
So, so just to add that, because we were using the United States dollar, we became uncompetitive. Our products were naturally more expensive to export, because the dollar is an overvalued currency. So it made sense now to capitalize on the domestic market. Both the disposable incomes were also in United States dollars. So it really made a bigger difference, because what the business person wants is to trade.
Yeah, and in any case, on top of that, Honorable, the issue is, look, you are looking at the dom. Is, I think we don't need to be very unfair to our local business businesses in this country. These are the same businesses that lost all the money to hyperinflation. You know, we lost money to hyperinflation. They lost money to, you know, a decade of hyperinflation. And so when the time came and the dollar recession came into effect, surely it made a lot of sense to allow the same businesses that had supported the government, that had been paying taxes, that had allowed the social services in this country to continue, to at least have you know, a faster way to recoup and to, you know, to restructure their balances. So in my opinion, I think at the end of the day, we really need to, I would be quite grateful even if we re-dollarize in the same businesses that exist today, that are suffering at the expense of rising inflation, etc., have the first right of refusal to restructure their balances in US dollars.
But the question I'm asking here is to say, for a long period, we were essentially what many people refer to as supermarket for South Africa, because South Africa would essentially just export to Zimbabwe and demand their payments in US dollars. So a lot of the businesses that were manufacturing at that time just decided, okay, we could just become supermarkets ourselves and stop. And for a long period, people stopped producing local products. So would the question again being, would that not have affected growth and the capacity to, or the appetite to actually create products? If
you see,
if there was, like you say, there was a faster way of making money.
Yeah, you see, it was not a faster way of making money. It was a faster way of restructuring balances that had been pulverized by inflation.
Mm.
Remember, you see, you need to be very, we need to be very careful when we listen to the business sector in this economy. For a very long time, between 2009 and 2002 and 2009, the business community in this country had been yearning for US dollars. Remember. People would, I remember I presented in many conferences, and the major issue was we need foreign currency, right?
I remember
when we got the foreign currency, we then started saying, oh no, I think it was a bad mistake, it was a bad dream. In fact, this dream has become real, and it was a mistake. It's too strong for us, so we need a weaker currency, right? So they were yearning for a weaker currency, right? And now we have a very weak bond note, and they're saying again, no, we need foreign currency. You get my point. So when you listen to or you evaluate the sentiments that are coming from the business sector, you know, if you're just sitting out there, you then get these conflicting signals, you see. But I guess what, at the end of the day, what we just need ourselves is a stable local currency.
Okay, 0731-168-045. And I saw there was a call that was trying to come in, 0772-168-045. I'm looking at the lines right now. And as soon as I get a call coming in, I'll get you on air. But then the question again then becomes the aspect of an economy going into recession. That remains unattractive for investors, doesn't it?
Well, it is unattractive because when you have good recession, even your domestic investors cannot invest. Let alone foreign investors. So what you then need is to stimulate the economy to come out of that recessionary period, and that cannot be done, that can only be done through injection of new capital into the economy and also ratcheting up domestic demand, aggregate demand by the consumers to create the necessary stimulus for production. There's no magic out of it. It has to be production and production and production.
And so therefore, when we look at a mantra, business, the mantra, Zimbabwe is open for business, are we saying that, is it being put on pause, or is it just not going to work?
Look, I think it's, look, we can't say it has been put on pause or it's not going to work. I think from a policy perspective, I guess the issue is to remain optimistic whilst coming up, I mean, putting up the right policies that are able to stabilize the economy. But to think that we'll be able to attract a lot of investment, it depends on the type of investments, like I said earlier. Those that are chasing our comparative advantages, I mean, look, if you look at the minerals, etc., look, this could be the best time to come in anyway because the asset values are now cheap. You see, when you want to buy anything in Zimbabwe and you've got foreign currency, you'll surely be able to snap a lot of things much cheaper, you see. So yes, we might be able to attract investment, but what is important, I guess, from a policy perspective is to look at the type of investment. So we don't need debt creating inflows. Or look, when you look at a structure or at a deal, we don't want a deal that actually creates a charge on your future current account. So we don't want debt creating inflows, loans that come into this country, because what they do is that you get a loan. So at the face of it, you think you are getting foreign currency, but actually you need to produce more actually to pay back the loan. And when you look at how clever the business community is out there, you know, there will be a lot of transfer pricing, etc. And at the end of the day, the country becomes worse off. So from my perspective, it's very important to remain positive in terms of attracting capital and in remaining open for business. But I guess we really need then to understand the type of business that we need. At the moment, my thinking is that when you look at the challenges that this economy is facing, we need jobs desperately, more than anything else. And we need decent jobs that can be created out there. So what we need to do is to be able to attract investment that creates decent jobs, sustainable jobs. All other investments that might not be able to assist in resolving the unemployment challenge in this economy, in my opinion, I don't think it's an investment that is worth considering.
I've worked in the investment area for quite some time. That there are just two things that an investor would like to, in fact, three things. The policy environment, the risk and the return.
Right.
At the present moment, I think the greatest risk to investment is the currency issue. Because if the investor comes and pours money into the economy, when you want to take your dividends, what form will it be? You know? And given the volatility in the exchange rate, between the parallel market rate and the official rate, what rate would the investor be guided by? So I think the question of currency poses a great risk, more than political risk in the present moment. You know, investors can invest when the risk is high, also the return can be high. Look at countries that, I mean, would you imagine companies investing in Afghanistan or Iraq?
Mm.
So they look at the risk and the return. So at the present moment, our risk lies not only political, but most importantly, the current risks. That is really scaring our investors.
So now what's happening is that under there's been talk of an agreement with the IMF that says policies that will focus on eliminating the government's double-digit euro fiscal deficit and the adoption of reforms to allow market forces to drive the function of foreign exchange and other financial markets. When we hear the idea of the IMF, you know, people start thinking, especially people old enough, is this not ISAP by a different name?
Well, the problem with these policies is that they address demand management policies. It's just looking at the demand side of things. You know, I don't see those policies looking at the supply side responses to make sure that we have production. They just say cut on this, cut on that, control your deficit. It's demand management. They are sharing away from the real sector, which is the supply side sector, from production. I want the IMF to recommend production stimulating measures. How do we resuscitate the manufacturing sector? How do we resuscitate tourism? How do we leverage on mining? How do we make sure that we have sustainable agriculture? Those are the policies that the IMF should be advising on, because if they are going to give us technical advice. But you find that most of the time, they want to see that you are able to repay your debt, to service your debts, and you are able to contain the budget deficit. But let's go beyond those traditional, what we call neoliberal prescriptions. We want the total transformation of the economy to create jobs, to create wealth, and to make sure that the economy grows. By double digit figures. That's what should be. That should be the economics of the day, not the economics of yesteryear. So I think the IMF has to change, to look at how to build the capacities of developing countries to grow, to produce, and how to cushion them against price volatilities when we export, especially in the mining and agricultural sectors. That is very important. Otherwise, we are vulnerable to external shocks.
So, given that sort of background, where you talk about the focus should be more on growth, how do you have both of them working with the debt? You know, we're talking about the current policy that is there. We talk about stabilization, plugging the holes. Can you do all those multiple things at the same time without any leakages going one way or the other?
Yeah, it's a delicate balance, but obviously, it depends on where the bias is. I wouldn't spend all the bias on filling up the holes. I would also start to try to produce and make sure that the economy grows. So it's a way of striking the balances with the right policies to follow that balance.
So one of the big things that's talked about a lot is the debt clearance, and we talk about external debt, for example, bilateral creditors are said to be put at 31.5% of the debt. In addition, external debt of 5.6 billion is mainly comprised of arrears. That is of a report by Finance Minister Ntulinqube that came out in the last couple of days. How do we get around this one?
Yeah, that's a very difficult one, especially when you consider the fact that this economy has not really run a surplus for a very long time, more than 2 decades, on the current account. And what it means, therefore, is that for us to be able to be readmitted into this, global, financial sphere where borrowers, good borrowers, meet their obligations, we really need to relook at our expenditure.
Okay, I want you to answer that, but I want to get, I've been looking at that call. So as soon as we get this after this call, I want you to carry on with that. You're live on ZFM Stereo. What's your name, contribution, and where are you calling from?
Hi, my name is Rob. I'm phoning from Eastleigh.
Go ahead, Rob.
Yes, hi. You know what? I think the thing is that we are looking at things like this. The first thing we need to do is get a buy-in from our citizens. How do you expect to grow a country where you don't even buy in from your citizens? Look, if you look at a country like Germany, they went through a war and they are in poverty. Japan, if you look at the same, they went to Hiroshima, hit them hard. But it took them 30 years just to build. Why? Because the citizen was backing it. Now you don't have a finance minister running a gallivanting all around the nation, just looking for donations. Can you help us? Can you help? When he doesn't look within, get the citizen buy-in. Make policies that agree with the citizens. And then the citizens will back your policies. And then we get growth. People are not happy because first you don't tell them you can't take money out of your bank. People don't want to hear that. Investors won't hear that. If your people can't hear that, then how do you expect investors to hear that? They won't hear that. So that's my idea. Look within and build, and then you have a social contract with citizens. Don't running around looking for them when you can't even social own it. Another thing I also feel, this country, you've got people who capture this country. People who got their roots deep in sectors, the key sectors of production that can actually build this country. Where, in fuel, there's someone who's there who doesn't want to lose his riches. So if we address those things within, people are not stupid. We see that. So let's address those things and not talk about this kind of. Yes, we can talk for areas, but you won't address that issue because people don't have confidence in you. So address confidence.
Thank you for your contribution. That's a critical point. Last week, when I had the guest, the permanent secretary in the Ministry of Information, was how much do people understand the policies, and how important is that, in as far as building confidence?
Yeah, the caller is quite spot on. Confidence is very, very key. People have to believe that these policies will work, and they have to be seen to be working,
and understand them,
and also participate in the formulation of those policies. Business has to be involved, civil society has to be involved, labor has got to be involved in the policy making process. So it's all about confidence at the end of the day. If government pronouncements are not believable, then they won't get traction from the population. It's about traction, positive responses from the people. And the greatest crisis I've said is the current crisis. But that's where confidence starts. If a person cannot go to the bank, can go to the bank and doesn't get the money, person puts his or her money in Forex, you get it, is RTGS dollar, there comes a problem. That's where confidence starts. So I think the caller is really right that we have to galvanize everybody in rebuilding this economy.
And there's something that is fundamental. You've just added on to it. If somebody who is here in Zimbabwe can't get money out of the bank themselves, an investor isn't going to think that they can come and get their money, never mind for running around within the country, but also back to their countries of origin, isn't it?
Yeah, true. That's very true. I think, like you're saying, I think we really need to be very honest from a policy, as a citizen and as a country, to say, look, do we have the right policies that can attract investment, and not just the Mickey Mouse investment, but real investment? And when I talk of investment, I'm not talking about foreign investment, because this country really does not read much of foreign investment. You see, that is the problem that sometimes we have with our policy making framework. We believe that it's only foreigners out there that can come and invest. and turn around the fortunes of this country, which is very wrong. Because when you look at what sustains this economy, when you look at VAT, collections by Zimra Pay, when you look at corporate tax, this is money that sustains the government, that sustains the social services in this country. It's money that is generated by the businesses that are already invested in this country. And what we need is to nurture these businesses, allow them to grow. And when they grow, you don't necessarily need to go out there and ask investors to come. When they see that there's money to be made in Zimbabwe, they'll come. They'll come in big numbers. We don't even need to go out there. We will probably need to then say, look, I think there are a lot of foreigners that are coming out. We then streamline them so that at least they don't suffocate our local investors. So my thinking is that we need to be focused on the domestic investor first. If we are going to have roadshows, let them be roadshows on the domestic investors, the investors that are currently sustaining lives in Zimbabwe.
And many, I know you want to add on to this, many people have said, okay, as a business, I've been essentially carrying the economy on my back, paying my taxes, and yet foreign investors come in and the first thing they get are tax breaks for X amount of years, and that seems to encourage them more than me. I don't know if you want to add on that.
Well, there's to be some complementarity between domestic investors and foreign investors. In most cases, yes, we want to promote our own domestic investors. By the end of the day, they don't have capital. And our domestic market, the interest rate structure, is inimical to the access of loans. So at the end of the day, the domestic investors would want to quote foreign capital credit lines into the country. So there has to be a complementarity. But I agree, we must not discriminate against our own investors. That means give them incentives. Good incentives, as good as we give to foreign investors, so that at least they can compete.
Yeah, in fact, you see, when you look at that, Honorable, that's where my problem is, that half the time, the guys that, you see, when you look at an investor in South Africa and an investor in Zimbabwe, an investor in South Africa has not had a decade of hyperinflation. They have not had a decade of high taxes and unreasonable taxes. But when you look at a local investor, the same investor that has been sustaining lives, I think we really need to be very honest about it. When you look at public service in this country, it's not supported by foreigners, it's supported by local investors that pay taxes, right? They are the same people that employ, that afford decent jobs out there, that can afford, that allow families to have a decent living. So when you then look at these two, the foreign investor and the domestic investor, my thinking is that the foreign investor is coming from the US. They've had good years, 100 years of good life. They have not had these high taxes that we've been subjected to. They have not had hyperinflation. And all of a sudden, it's the same investor again that we then want to say, okay, how can we incentivize you to come? You see, so my thinking is that we don't necessarily need incentives whatsoever. The domestic investors, I think, they have been very good. They have been very resilient. They have not been running on any incentives whatsoever. In fact, they have been disincentivized by high inflation and high taxes, you see. So what we probably just need in this economy, Honorable, where I'm not so much keen on incentivizing or even having complementarity. I believe that in business, if we just have the right policies, I believe that the local investors in the Zimbabwe, they are well-heeled, they've got capital. Yes, they don't have access to foreign lines of credit, but look at what happened in 2009. There were no lines of credit that were coming in, but companies, because they are entrepreneurs and they believe in business and that's their lifeblood, they create the environment and they are able to access funds, and eventually, look at what happened. We started producing.
But that's another thing that is to be asked. Like, for example, in the United States, what's his name, the Amazon guy, he is worth $150 billion. And New York wanted him to come and set up a head office there. And they're offering him $3 billion. So would it not be also that kind of scenario where you're saying, okay, should we keep making the rich richer at the expense of the poorer? I know you talk about complementarity, but he's talking about suffocating the local businessman who does not have access to those lines of credit that that a foreigner will have.
There's no contradiction. We've already agreed that we must promote our own domestic investors, yes, for sure. But also realizing that we must also help them to access working capital, foreign capital, lines of credit. We must also do that. You remember in 2009, There was a lot that government did in the during the GNU. Opening lines of credit, the Afrexim Bank facility was brought into the country, the other facilities from China and so on and so forth. So there was that attempt, that conscious and deliberate attempt to make sure that our local businesses get lines of credit and get access to capital. So that's where that's the complementarity I'm referring to. Don't leave them alone. Help them to access lines of credit.
Yeah, true. But I think what I would add on that and say, look, you see, the problem with foreign investors is that they are very sensitive. They ship in, they ship out quickly, you see. And what they then do, you see, you don't want an economy to be really resting on the, or, you know, on foreign capital. Look at what has been happening on the Zimbabwe Stock Exchange. When foreigners just sense danger, they start selling and they want to exit quickly, you see, because they don't have their roots here whatsoever, you see. So I believe, yes, we definitely need complementarity, but I think government effort. I'm not happy when the government is so keen on attracting, you know, the focus for government for some time has been to attract investment. That is the wrong policy. And in any case, when investors out there start hearing the government wanting, quoting them, they start asking, but what's wrong with that country actually? Why are they, you know, offering us all these sweet things, you see? Because most of these economies out there, they are not really so much, you know, outgoing in terms of, you know, attracting or courting foreign investment. If we make the environment right, if we make the conditions right and the local businesses thrive in this country, I can tell you everyone out there will be wanting to take part in this country. The very reason, like you were saying, you find people in Afghanistan, they are looking for the right conditions where they can make money. So what is important is to have a stable policy, predictable, you know. The most important risk that we have in this country, like you said, is the currency risk. As long as you have no confidence whatsoever in the currency, it becomes very difficult even for the local investors to invest, because you may actually wipe out your working capital, you see.
So, before we go, I want to ask, how do we get out of that? I know we talked about the currency risk, so we're going into recession. How do we get out of it? And do you think we can get out of it this year, or we're going to have to go through a continued recession next year, given that TSP has said that it needs to go all the way until 2020?
Yeah, recessions are cyclical. In most cases, they can take 3 years. 3 year cycle, 5 year cycle, 10 year cycle, depending on what interventions you make. Yeah. In our case, agriculture, rebound in agriculture, depends on the weather, climatic conditions in the main. Of course, there are other issues like imports and so on and so forth. But we hope that we can have a good season next year, so that we can have a good output in agriculture. Now, mining is about prices. Prices are low on the international market. They are low. They are still volatile. So the earnings also get affected. Through that process. Incomes are low. We have to increase people's incomes. Right now, the mismatch between the price levels and people's incomes is so shocking. We have to increase the incomes of people so that they can be able to drive the demand and stimulate economic activity. Right. Then production itself, the manufacturing sector, we have to retool and give them more foreign currency so that they can import raw materials to kickstart their productive activities. So it's not a short-term thing. It can take long, multiple periods, depending on how strategic your interventions are.
Okay, and before going 2 minutes, the same question.
Yeah, my thinking is that, look, when you look at the challenges, our challenges, like I said earlier, are stemming from excessive money supply growth. And I'm not convinced that with the drought that is coming and the loans or the external, the number of foreign obligations that we need to meet as a country, you know, the loans that we need to pay off, we'll be able to manage money supply growth to reasonable levels in the next 1 or 2 years. So my thinking is that we definitely would be in a recession for at least 2 years minimum before we reach rock bottom. So it definitely has to get a bit worse before it gets better, because there is a lot of money that is still around that has doesn't have the correct value. Because we have a lot of money that we printed subsidizing basic commodities, etc. And until such a time that we have decimated all that balloon, we can then probably start having a sound footing before we can start growing the economy. And my thinking is that when you look at the levels of domestic disposable incomes, they are very much low now, probably the 2009 levels, and you don't expect that you'll be able to bump them up to, you know, significantly in the next 1 or 2 years. It's impossible. And in any case, corporates have lost working capital, and it's not going to be easy actually to regain, you know, the real value of the working capital. And as such, look, it's not all gloomy, but I think this is necessary that this economy actually goes through this recession so that at least we have a strong footing for growth going forward. Anything else that we might be able to put our foundation on right now would be shaken, would not be sustainable.
Okay, well, I suppose, yeah, just after listening to that, you just want to go home and sleep. Thank you very much, Mr. Brains Mchema, speaking the economist, and Dr. Tapio Mashakada, who is also honourable, is the MDC MP for Hatfield and is a former Minister of Economic Planning and Investment Promotion. Both of you, thank you very much for coming in, and you're always welcome to come and explain your insights to the nation.
Thank you. Have a
good evening. Stay tuned to ZFM Stereo. Coming up is Chila with Our Story. I'm back with you tomorrow on Health Matters. Otherwise, as I always say, my name is Larry Quirai. For Bulawayo, we say, I see it with Sasevenza. Take care of yourself.